And now we begin the reading of today's Boston Herald for this Monday, the 6th of April, 2026. And with today's Boston Herald, we say hello to Alicia.
Hello, everyone. Happy Monday. And here are your stories from today's Boston Herald. Trump issues fiery new threats, promises living in hell if Strait of Hormuz isn't opened. Tehran. U.S. President Donald Trump on Sunday made expletive-filled threats against Iran and its infrastructure if it doesn't open the Strait of Hormuz by a Tuesday deadline. A defiant Iran, meanwhile, struck infrastructure targets in neighboring Gulf Arab countries and threatened to restrict another heavily used regional waterway, the Bab al-Mandeb Strait, off the Arabian Peninsula. Trump, on social media, vowed to hit Iran's power plants and bridges and said the country would be living in hell if the Strait of Hormuz, crucial for global trade, isn't opened. He ended with, "Praise be to Allah." Trump told Axios he will be blowing up everything over there if Iran doesn't make a deal. He said he plans to hold a news conference at 1 p.m. on Monday and also posted about a Tuesday 8 p.m. deadline without offering any details about what he meant. Trump has issued such deadlines before, but extended them when mediators have claimed progress toward ending the war, which has killed thousands, shaken global markets, and spiked fuel prices in just over 5 weeks. It seems Trump has become a phenomenon that neither Iranians nor Americans are able to fully analyze, Iranian Culture Minister Syed Reza Salehi Amiri told visiting journalists in an interview in Tehran, adding that the U.S. president constantly shifts between contradictory positions. Both sides have threatened and hit civilian targets like oil fields and desalination plants, critical for drinking water. Iran's UN mission called Trump's threat clear evidence of intent to commit war crime. Iran's Joint Military Command warned of stepped-up attacks on regional oil and civilian infrastructure if the U.S. and Israel attack such targets there, according to state television. The laws of armed conflict allow attacks on civilian infrastructure only if the military advantage outweighs the civilian harm, legal scholars say. It's considered a high bar to clear, and causing excessive suffering to civilians can constitute a war crime. Iran rejected Trump's ultimatum to reopen the Strait of Hormuz, saying the strait would only reopen fully when damage from the war is compensated. Tehran continued to strike energy targets in its Gulf neighbors, including Kuwait's oil headquarters. Oman's foreign minister said the deputy foreign ministers and experts from Iran and Oman met to discuss proposals to ensure smooth transit through the strait. Egypt said that Foreign Minister Badr Abdeladi had spoken with U.S. Envoy Steve Witkoff and Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi, and with Turkish and Pakistani counterparts. Russia said that Araghchi also spoke with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. Bahrain urged the UN Security Council to act on its draft proposal with language authorizing defensive action to ensure safe passage through the strait. In the United Arab Emirates, authorities said that 4 people, 1 Nepali and 3 Pakistani, were hurt in fires caused by debris from the interception of an Iranian projectile at Khor Fakkan port, and interception debris caused fires at a petrochemical plant in Ruwais, halting operations. In Kuwait, Iranian drone attacks caused significant damage to power plants and a petrochemical plant. They also put a water desalination station out of service, according to the Ministry of Electricity. In Bahrain, a drone attack caused a fire at a national oil company storage facility and a state-run petrochemical plant, the kingdom's official news agency said. In Israel, rescue authorities searched for 3 people in the northern city of Haifa, after an apartment building was hit. It wasn't immediately clear what struck it. Israel assesses that Iran still has more than 1,000 missiles capable of reaching it, while Hezbollah's arsenal in Lebanon includes as many as 10,000 shorter-range rockets, according to military briefings cited by Israeli media this week. Israel said it struck a petrochemical complex in southwestern Iran, where Tehran said 5 people were killed and 170 others wounded. Iran announced Saturday that Iraq would be exempt from its shipping restrictions in the strait, allowing for as much as 3 million barrels a day of Iraqi oil cargoes. An Iraqi official struck a cautious note, saying volumes would depend on whether shipping companies are willing to risk entering the strait. Iraqi Foreign Minister Fuad Hussein, who met Iran's ambassador on Sunday, said the two countries agreed on the need to continue their cooperation on allowing Iraqi oil to pass through Hormuz. Oil prices have been roiled by the conflict and soaring costs for products such as jet fuel and diesel, and are threatening a renewed wave of inflation. OPEC Plus members raised their production quotas for May in a symbolic move as the war constrains production and shipments from several of the alliance's largest members. In the U.S., average national retail gasoline prices have topped $4 a gallon for the first time since 2022. Crossing that critical psychological threshold brings some political risk to the Trump administration and Republicans as consumers grow increasingly concerned over the cost of living in the months ahead of November's midterms. More than 5,000 people have been killed in the conflict, almost three-quarters of them in Iran, according to government organizations and the U.S.-based human rights activist news agency. More than 1,460 people have been killed in Lebanon, where Israel is fighting a parallel war against Iran-allied Hezbollah. We got him. Downed U.S. flyer retrieved from behind enemy lines in daring operation, by Joe Dwinell. We got him. President Donald Trump announced before the sun was up on Easter Sunday that a brave American colonel had been rescued after being shot down over Iran. It was one of the most daring search and rescue operations in U.S. history, the president added, and has now left no one behind in enemy territory. The U.S. went searching for the Air Force officer after a Friday crash of his F-15E Strike Eagle, as Iran also promised a reward for anyone who turned in an enemy pilot, the Associated Press reported. The aviator was the second member of the downed F-15E to be rescued, and he was injured, the president added, but made it out. The two airmen ejected over southwestern Iran. The weapons officer was injured during the ejection but was still able to walk and was the last to be rescued, the New York Post reported, quoting Axios. The missing colonel was shot down in southwestern Iran, according to multiple reports. The Wall Street Journal added that the airman, who eluded capture for 36 hours and hid in a remote mountain crevice, was rescued by a specialized commando force. The CIA also used a deception operation to give the rescue mission time to succeed. We have to get him, Trump said, according to White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt. The journal added some 100 special operations forces and dozens of U.S. warplanes and helicopters were used. Reuters reported that Iranians claimed 2 C-130 military transport planes and 2 Black Hawk helicopters were destroyed, with other reports saying that the U.S. blew up the craft to not leave any sensitive technology behind. Trump added in his post that the United States military pulled off one of the most daring search and rescue operations in U.S. history for one of our incredible crew member officers, who also happens to be a highly respected colonel, and who I am thrilled to let you know is now safe and sound. This has all come after the news of the coordinated search and rescue of the downed airmen. U.S. Central Command, in debunking Iran's latest claim, said all U.S. fighter aircraft are accounted for. This rescue also robs Iran of leverage in any negotiations now that they don't have a prisoner of war to use as propaganda. This brave warrior was behind enemy lines in the treacherous mountains of Iran, being hunted down by our enemies, who were getting closer and closer by the hour, but was never truly alone because his commander-in-chief, Secretary of War, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and fellow warfighters were monitoring his location 24 hours a day and diligently planning for his rescue. The Wall Street Journal added the CIA assisted in the operation, confusing Iran about the status of the rescue mission, and drones were used to keep others away from the pilot. At my direction, the U.S. military sent dozens of aircraft armed with the most lethal weapons in the world to retrieve him. He sustained injuries, but he will be just fine. This miraculous search and rescue operation comes in addition to a successful rescue of another brave pilot yesterday, which we did not confirm because we did not want to jeopardize our second rescue operation. This is the first time in military memory that two U.S. pilots have been rescued separately deep in enemy territory, the president added. He ended his post with, "We will never leave an American war fighter behind. The fact that we were able to pull off both of these operations without a single American killed or even wounded just proves once again that we have achieved overwhelming air dominance and superiority over the Iranian skies. This is a moment that all Americans, Republican, Democrat, and everyone else should be proud of and united around." Lawmakers to hear anti-ICE bill. Legislation seeks to allow illegal immigrants and others to sue agents. By Tim Dunn. Beacon Hill. The Joint Committee on the Judiciary will be taking up a bill Tuesday that would allow illegal immigrants and anyone else arrested or detained by Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, to sue the agents who took them into custody. The proposed bill, an act relative to violations of the United States Constitution under the color of law, S-2976, was filed in February by State Senator William Brownsberger and would mirror a federal statute that dates back to the Reconstruction era and allowed citizens to sue state law enforcement for civil rights violations and excessive force. Over the past few weeks, federal agents have brutalized people on the streets of Minneapolis. No police necessity can explain their excessive use of force, which has shocked and disgusted fair-minded people across the political spectrum. In the absence of a federal administration willing to hold its agents accountable when they depart from civil norms, states need to impose liability and make court-ordered relief available, Brownsberger wrote in a February release announcing the legislation. The proposed act applies equally to local, state, and federal officers. However, it has the effect of creating new liability only for federal officers. The proposed act will not alter the liability of state and local police officers because they are already subject to liability for violations of the United States Constitution. It's the latest in a flurry of anti-ICE legislation filed by Massachusetts lawmakers, including the PROTECT Act, which just passed the House and is just a Senate vote away from reaching Governor Maura Healey's desk, and would ban ICE agents from making civil arrests in Massachusetts courthouses and other places, among other measures. Throughout this legislative session, Senate President Karen Spilka has made clear that the Senate Committee on Steering and Policy is committed to protecting our residents and defending our values in the face of ongoing attacks by the federal government. Recently, Senate President Spilka stood firmly with the Healey-Driscoll administration in its efforts to shield residents from the ongoing abuses of the Department of Homeland Security and ICE, said the Democratic members of the Senate Committee on Steering and Policy in a written statement announcing the filing of the bill. This bill is one element of a broader ongoing review of immigrant protections being undertaken by the Senate, and the Committee on Steering and Policy will continue its work to advance additional proposals. We are deeply aware of the urgency of these matters, the statement said. Similar legislation has been filed by State Senator Rebecca Rausch, called an act supporting the pursuit of justice against ICE, S-3639. In a February press release announcing her legislation, which was included in a suite of five anti-ICE bills, Rausch accuses the Federal Immigration Agency of being the cause of growing chaos and dangerousness in its operations. ICE's recklessness defies both democracy and safety. Their actions are a gut punch to American values and human decency. We can and should pursue all of our options here in Massachusetts to protect our communities and ensure accountability. These bills aim to rein in ICE from operating with dangerous impunity and defend our civil and constitutional rights, said Rausch. Among the other anti-ICE bills filed by Rausch is one called An Act to De-ICE Massachusetts Law Enforcement, S-3638, that would ban local and state police from hiring any current or former ICE agent. A law enforcement agency shall not employ, hire, contract with, or in any way retain the services of any individual who was hired as a sworn officer or otherwise provided services as an agent of or advisor to the United States Immigration and Customs Enforcement on or after January 20th, 2025, the legislation reads. The legislation also comes as Healy, Attorney General Andrea Campbell, and several state lawmakers have expressed their intent to prosecute ICE agents carrying out operations in Massachusetts. Last month, Healy implied that she would be open to prosecuting federal agents who violate state law using information gathered by a new online portal she created with AG Campbell for Massachusetts residents to report potentially unlawful activity by agents conducting operations in the state. My job is to protect public safety here in Massachusetts, and opening that portal is part of it, so that people have a way to communicate what they're observing, and if ICE agents are engaged and things are unlawful, then expect them to be held accountable, Healy told the Herald. Just last week, during the No Kings rally at the Boston Common, Campbell directly asked state residents to use the portal in order for her office to carry out prosecutions of federal agents. We need you to record your videos of any interactions that you see and to upload your stories, your videos, all of it, secretly, safely, so that we can get that information and do what with it? Review it, investigate, and prosecute anyone who is violating our laws, who is harming our people, and who is threatening your safety, Campbell said to tens of thousands of protesters. The committee will hear the testimony on Brownsburger's bill on Tuesday at 1 p.m. in hearing room A2 of the State House. A live stream will also occur. Suspect dead after shootout with police, by Grace Zakovich. A 38-year-old man who allegedly shot a cop was found dead after a shootout with police in the woods in Raymond, New Hampshire, on Saturday night, New Hampshire Attorney General John Formella stated. Around 1:30 p.m. Saturday, police responded to Ham Road in Raymond on a report that a man had fired a long gun at family members, according to the Attorney General's office. The suspect, Matthew Massey, 38, was found armed at the scene. Upon arrival, Massey allegedly fired his rifle at responding officers and hit a cop with the Nottingham Police Department. The officers sustained non-life-threatening injuries, the Formella's office said, and was actively being treated as of Sunday. Massey allegedly then fled into the woods, Formella said. Authorities issued a shelter-in-place order for nearby residents and began to search for the suspect. Police made contact with Massey in a wooded area around 10:06 p.m., the AG said, and attempted to take him into custody. The Attorney General said there was an exchange of gunfire between Massey and the officers, after which the suspect was found dead by police as they approached his location. Law enforcement did not immediately state Massey's cause of death on Sunday. An autopsy to determine the cause and manner of death is scheduled for early this week, the AG's office said. More information is expected to be released following the autopsy. Pursuant to protocol, the names of the officers involved in the exchange of gunfire with Mr. Massey are being withheld pending the conclusion of formal interviews, the AG said. He stated there is no further threat to the public at this time on Sunday. Shoplifting suspects nabbed at Prudential Mall by Grace Sokovich. A man and woman were arrested after allegedly stealing over $1,700 in merchandise from shops on Newbury Street and in the Prudential Mall, according to Boston police. At about 6:40 p.m. Friday, police state they received a report of shoplifting in the Aloe store in the Prudential building. The two suspects were reportedly seen concealing multiple items into a bag and exited the store, BPD said. The pair left the store as responding officers were involved with another shoplifting incident, police said. Later the same day, police received another report of the suspects allegedly stealing from the Aloe store on Newbury Street, BPD stated. The male suspect, later identified as Floyd Somerville, 55, of the Bronx, New York, exited the store. The female suspect, identified as Tiffany Jones, 45, remained inside. Somerville was reportedly stopped on 279 Dartmouth Street and put into handcuffs, at which time officers recovered stolen merchandise, police said. Officers also found a key fob and vehicle parked on Dartmouth Street, recovering more allegedly stolen merchandise inside, Boston police said. The total merchandise added up to $1,726, according to BPD. Jones was stopped as she exited the store and arrested, during which she allegedly provided officers with multiple names, police stated. Her identity was determined during the booking process. Both suspects were charged with larceny over $1,200 and conspiracy. Jones faces additional charges of receiving stolen property over $1,200 and providing law enforcement false ID information. Ghost gun seized. After 9 p.m. on Friday, Boston police also took several juveniles into custody after finding a large-capacity firearm on one and engaging in an altercation with a group of teens. Police with the Youth Violence Strike Force responded to a report of a large party around 5 Metcalf Court in Jamaica Plain, where they found a teen boy seated with about 8 people. As the responders approached in a cruiser, the juvenile male stood and began walking away at a fast pace, police said. When officers exited the car, the teen reportedly broke into a full sprint, BPD said, and another individual followed him. One of the teens was seen clutching the left side of his jacket while running, police stated. The pair entered a doorway at 5 Metcalf Court, BPD said, where police caught up and prevented them from closing the door. The officers conducted a pat frisk, allegedly finding a firearm from one suspect's jacket, police said. When they put the boy in handcuffs, the second teen attempted to interfere, refused to comply with orders, and struck an officer, according to police. Police said the group became combative and the situation escalated, leading to a third individual to allegedly attempt to assault officers. The three suspects were taken into custody, BPD said. The recovered firearm was identified as an alleged ghost gun, equipped with a large-capacity extended magazine loaded with 10 rounds. One 16-year-old male was charged with delinquent unlawful possession of a firearm, large-capacity feeding device, and ammunition, and carrying a loaded firearm, and is expected to be arraigned in West Roxbury District Court. The two other teens will be summoned to West Roxbury District Court on charges of assault and battery on a police officer and disorderly conduct. Pope urges peace in Easter Mass from the Associated Press, Vatican City. Pope Leo XIV celebrated his first Easter Mass as pontiff with a call Sunday to lay down arms and seek peace to global conflicts through dialogue. Leo, the first U.S.-born pope, emphasized Easter's message of hope as a celebration of Jesus' resurrection after being crucified. Let us allow our hearts to be transformed by his immense love for us. Let those who have weapons lay them down. Let those who have the power to unleash wars choose peace, not a peace imposed by force, but through dialogue, not with the desire to dominate others, but to encounter them, the Pope implored. With the U.S.-Israeli war on Iran in its second month and Russia's ongoing campaign in Ukraine, Leo acknowledged a sense of indifference to the deaths of thousands of people, to the repercussions of hatred and division that conflicts sow, to the economic and social consequences they produce. Without mentioning the wars by name, Leo quoted his predecessor, Pope Francis, who during his last public appearance from the same loggia last Easter, reminded the faithful of the great thirst for death, for killing, we witness each day. Francis, weakened by a long illness, died the next day on Easter Monday. Earlier, Leo addressed some 50,000 faithful from an open-air altar in St. Peter's Square, flanked with white roses, while the steps leading down to the piazza where the faithful gathered were filled with spring perennials, symbolically resonating with the Pope's words. He implored the faithful in his homily to keep their hope in the face of death, which lurks in the abuses that crush the weakest among us because of the idolatry of profit that plunders the earth's resources, because of the violence of war that kills and destroys. Speaking from the loggia, the Pope announced a prayer vigil for peace, April 11th, in the Basilica. Mostly dry, a late-week warm-up ahead, by Grace Sakovich. After a brief chance of early precipitation, Boston is likely in for a mostly dry week and warmer temperatures heading into next weekend, according to National Weather Service forecasts. In terms of rain and everything, that'll be continuing to clear out Sunday night, if it hasn't already, said NWS meteorologist Candace Renison. Monday should be pretty dry. Monday is set to kick off the week with some dry and breezy weather throughout the day, forecasts show. Winds are expected to reach gusts as high as 26 miles an hour, and temperatures are likely to climb up in a high in the upper 40s, NWS states. The only real chance for showers in the week should hit Monday night into Tuesday, Renison said. Monday night we could see some more showers come in once again, she said. They might be mixed with some snow, but wouldn't really accumulate or anything, and probably melt pretty quick, because we'd be going from like the mid-30s or so overnight, Monday, into the 40s during the day, Tuesday, pretty quickly, and that should switch over to rain. Rain is likely Tuesday, forecast show, especially around the afternoon. The day is expected to be partly sunny, with a high in the upper 40s. The night is forecasted to get chilly, NWS states, with a low dipping down in the upper 20s. Then Wednesday, we kind of get back into the mid-40s during the day, once again, said Renison. And then overnight, a little bit better, but still pretty cold for Wednesday night. Not as bad as Tuesday night, a few degrees improvement. Wednesday is expected to be sunny, with a high in the upper 40s and a nighttime low in the mid-30s, forecasts show. Boston will kick off a warming trend more so toward the second half of the week, Renison said. And then by Thursday into Friday, we'd see highs into the mid-50s and then into the mid-60s, heading into the weekend, Renison said. Thursday is forecasted to be sunny again, with the high climbing up to the mid-50s and a low in the low 40s in WS states. Friday into the weekend is preliminarily expected to remain partly sunny, with highs reaching up into the 60s through Sunday, forecast show. Congo to receive some U.S. deportees under new deal, from the Associated Press. Kinshasa, Congo. Congo will receive some migrants as part of a new deal under the Trump administration's third country program, its government said Sunday, the latest such African nation to receive migrants being deported from the U.S. The deportees will start arriving in Congo this month, the Congolese Ministry of Communications said in a statement, without further details on the date or the number of deportees expected. It described the arrangement as a temporary one that reflects Congo's commitment to human dignity and international solidarity. It would come with zero cost to the government, with the U.S. covering the needed logistics, it said. The U.S. has struck such third country deportation deals with at least seven other African nations, many of them among countries hit the most by the Trump administration's policies that have restricted trade, aid, and migration. The Trump administration has spent at least $40 million to deport about 300 migrants to countries other than their own, according to a report released recently by the Democratic staff of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Lawyers and activists have raised questions over the nature of the deals with countries in Africa and elsewhere. Several of the African nations that have signed such deals have notoriously repressive governments and poor human rights records, including Eswatini, South Sudan, and Equatorial Guinea. A key bone of contention in many such agreements is that they involve many migrants with protection orders from a U.S. immigration judge not to be returned to their home countries over major safety concerns. Congo's government said no automatic transfer of the deportees is planned, adding each situation will be subject to individual review in accordance with the laws of the republic and national security requirements. Screenwriters Union Studios reach 4-year tentative agreement, from the Associated Press, Los Angeles. The Screenwriters Union and Hollywood Studios reached a surprise 4-year tentative agreement after roughly 3 weeks of negotiation. The Writers Guild of America West said on X that its negotiating committee unanimously approved a tentative agreement with the Alliance of Motion Picture and Television Producers, which represents studios. The Alliance confirmed the deal in a separate statement on its website Saturday. We look forward to building on this progress as we continue working toward agreements that support long-term industry stability, read the Alliance statement. The precise terms of the deals were not immediately announced, but it is expected to include several writers' priorities, such as better health care plans and more protections against artificial intelligence. The union said on X that the deal protects the writers' health plan, builds on gains from 2023, and helps address free work challenges. The contract agreement, a year longer than a typical 3-year agreement, must be approved by the Guild's board and its members before it is ratified. The surprise agreement came within weeks of negotiation, a stark contrast to the contentious contract negotiation 3 years ago when Hollywood writers went on a historic strike that partially brought the industry to a standstill. The screenwriters voted almost unanimously to approve that agreement, which provided them with more compensation, length of employment, and control of artificial intelligence. The current contract was set to expire in May. The studios were also working on new deals with union leaders representing actors and directors whose contracts are set to expire at the end of June. Sean Astin, president of the SAG-AFTRA, said in a February interview with the Associated Press that he has seen signs that the studios want to work as partners again. Hollywood actors also walked out of their jobs for months in 2023, demanding a better contract. The writers' tentative deal with studios came as the Writers Guild of America, West, faces an ongoing strike by its own staff union that started in February. More than 100 people working in legal, events, and residuals departments went on strike over allegations of unfair labor practice, according to the Los Angeles Times. It is not clear how or whether the weeks-long strike would have an impact on the tentative deal with the studios. The union announced last month it canceled its annual awards ceremony because of the staff union strike. Kerouac Center teams up with Spinners. Lowell institutions join forces in fundraising effort for Literary Center. By Peter Currier from the Lowell Sun. Lowell. The Lowell Spinners are revived. The planned Jack Kerouac Center has more backing than ever after years of delay, and now both organizations are joining forces for a fundraising partnership. The Jack Kerouac Center and the Lowell Spinners are launching a season-long fundraising campaign together to help support the restoration of Lowell's St. John Baptiste Church, where author Jack Kerouac served as an altar boy and where his funeral was held in 1969. The Kerouac Foundation had been established in 2022 to purchase the church property and create the Kerouac Center, but efforts stalled for some time amid funding issues. That effort saw a dramatic turnaround with last year's purchase of the property by country singer and songwriter Zach Bryan for $3.4 million to help facilitate the center's creation. Bryan took it a step further last month when he purchased a number of manuscripts and letters by Kerouac at an auction of the estate of late Indianapolis Colts owner Jim Irsay, with the intent of bringing those items back to Lowell for the Kerouac Center. That included the scroll on which Kerouac first wrote his most famous novel, On the Road, which Bryan purchased at the auction for $12.1 million. Like the efforts to make the Kerouac Center happen saw a revival, so did the Lowell Spinners. The Spinners were a minor league team for the Boston Red Sox from 1996 to 2020, before the team was dissolved in Major League Baseball's reorganization of the minor league system. Now the Spinners are back in the form of a team for the Futures Collegiate Baseball League, and they, too, are playing a role in making the Kerouac Center happen. Kerouac's legacy as an amateur artist-athlete will serve as one of our guiding pillars for the revived franchise. We are inspired by Jack's amateur play and lifelong love of baseball, Lowell Spinners chairman and CEO John Croteau said in a statement. Proceeds from the season will go toward the transformation of the St. Jean Baptiste Church into the Kerouac Center, with exhibitions, a 1,500-seat room for music and storytelling performances, a recording studio, classrooms, and a home for archives like those secured by Bryan in the Irsay Estate auction. Jack Kerouac wrote about movement, about people, about searching, Kerouac Estate literary executor Jim Sampas said in a statement. But all of that came out of Lowell. It shaped who he was. Baseball was part of his life here, just like the streets, the people, the city. Seeing those worlds come together like this feels sincerely who he really was. Before he rose to become a world-renowned author, Kerouac played baseball for Lowell High School and the Twilight League in the summers, and carried a love for the sports throughout his life, even going so far as to create an elaborate fantasy baseball league himself. During the Spinners' upcoming season, marking their return, fans can expect to see Kerouac-related activities and events and ways to get involved with not just the team, but with what this project is becoming, the Jack Kerouac Center said in a statement Monday. This project is Lowell, said Jack Kerouac, Estate Marketing and Business Development Director Sylvia Cunha. We're creating a cultural hub that's going to take a lot of work to get done, and we need partners, support, and the community behind it. We're grateful to the Lowell Spinners for stepping up and being part of this with us and helping move these fundraising efforts forward. Tickets for the new Lowell Spinners season are now available at lowellspinners.com. Their season begins on May 29th at Le Leisure Park against the Nashua Silver Knights. August 1st will be a Jack Kerouac tribute night and bobblehead giveaway for the Spinners during their matchup against the Westfield Starfires. For more information about the Jack Kerouac Center, visit jackkerouaccenter.com. From the business pages, meatpacking strike on hold. Workers at one of the nation's largest meatpacking plants have agreed to return to work and halt a three-week strike after plant owner JBS USA agreed to resume negotiations, labor union representatives said over the weekend. The strike by thousands of workers at the Swift Beef Company plant in Greeley, Colorado, began on March 16th in coordination with the United Food and Commercial Workers Local 7 Union in a bid for higher wages and better health care. The strike came as U.S. cattle numbers hit a 75-year-old low this year, a decline driven in part by drought and low prices offered to ranchers. Meanwhile, beef prices have soared to record levels, adding to economic anxiety in the U.S. The union said in a statement that workers will return to work Tuesday morning after plant owner JBS USA agreed to reopen talks later in the week. Workers remain united and will continue to fight, said local union president Kim Cordova in a statement. Amazon adding surcharge on third-party sellers. Amazon is slapping a 3.5% fuel and logistics surcharge on third-party sellers using its platform starting later this month amid a spike in fuel prices since the war in Iran started. The temporary charge is effective April 17th for many of the sellers who use Amazon's fulfillment services, the online behemoth confirmed. Elevated costs in fuel and logistics have increased the cost of operating across the industry, Amazon said in the emailed statement. The Seattle-based company said it has absorbed these increases so far, but similar to other major carriers, when costs remain elevated, it implements temporary surcharges to partially recover these costs. It noted the charge is meaningfully lower than surcharges applied by other major carriers. From the sports pages, Vukovic looks rusty but feels pretty good in return. See, center is back after missing a month with a fractured finger. By Zach Cox. May 5th, 2025, Game 1 of the Eastern Conference Signals semifinals against New York. That was the last time, before Sunday, that Joe Mazzulla had his entire roster available for a Celtics game. Boston finally ended that 11-month drought in its 115-101 win over the Toronto Raptors at TD Garden. Veteran big man Nikola Vukovic's return from a fractured ring finger gave Mazzulla a full squad to work with for the first time this season. Vukovic showed clear signs of rust in his first game back, finishing with 4 points, 4 rebounds, 1 assist, 2 turnovers, and 4 fouls. Toronto outscored Boston by 14 points across his 13 minutes, a far cry from starting center Nemias Keita's plus 30 in 34 minutes. But Vukovic came away encouraged by his performance. Just try to find my ways and be able to be myself within what we're trying to do, within what is helping us be a good team, Vukovic said. And then I think, as I play more alongside these guys, I learn their tendencies. They learn mine. And I think that will just come naturally. I think today, honestly, when I was playing out there, I felt pretty good, pretty comfortable in the flow of the offense, defense, things like that. It wasn't perfect. There were mistakes, things like that. But I felt pretty good. Vukovic, the Celtics' top trade deadline acquisition, suffered his injury minutes into Jason Tatum's season debut on March 6th. He underwent surgery the following day and missed the next 14 games, continuing to meet and travel with the team while he recovered. During games, Vukovic would pick the brains of assistant coaches DJ McClay and Tony Dobbins about defensive coverages and matchup nuances. In practice, he'd run through drills left-handed to maintain his conditioning. Now healthy, the 35-year-old will use the final week of the regular season to reacclimate to game speed, regain the chemistry he built during his 12 pre-injury appearances, and develop an on-court connection with Tatum, with whom he played alongside for the first time on Sunday. Boston has 4 games remaining before the playoffs. As he continues to get some reps the next couple games, that's stuff we iron out, said Jaylen Brown, whose miscommunication with Vukovic on a pick and roll resulted in a third quarter turnover. But it's great to have him back. He looks good so far, but we've just got to keep building toward the playoffs. The Celtics went 10-4 in Vukovic's absence, getting strong front court play from Keita and backup Luka Garza. Mazzulla said the big man's month-long layoff actually helped him digest the Celtics system, which he had been learning on the fly after his February trade from Chicago. Obviously, getting healthy was priority number one, keeping his condition number two, Mazzulla said. He's been at every film session, every walkthrough, practice, shoot-around that we've had, so I think it's kind of maybe even slowed down for him. I think seeing the game live from a different perspective, he was sitting right next to DMAC and the staff, and just kind of seeing the game from a different standpoint, hearing the communication, I think it just slowed down for him and probably gave him even a better perspective. Raptors head coach Darko Rajakovic joked that he told Vukovic, a skilled shooter who's averaged more than 4 three-point attempts per game in each of the last 7 seasons, to try shooting left-handed to rest his newly recovered right hand. Vukovic missed both of his threes against Toronto, going 2-for-5 from the field. Nikola brings a wealth of experience to this team, Rajakovic said pregame. He's a player that can do so many things. He's great playing at the top of the key, shooting, connecting with teammates, playmaking. He can also post up when needed, especially against matchups. Good offensive rebounder. He's a complete player, and he's a great fit with this team. UCLA storms past South Carolina to claim first title. From the Associated Press, Phoenix. It's mission accomplished for UCLA. Gabriela Jaquez, Lauren Betts, and the rest of the UCLA seniors secured the first NCAA Women's Basketball National Championship in school history, a goal that was set after losing in the first Final Four last season. Jaquez scored 21 points, Betts added 16, and UCLA routed South Carolina 79-51 Sunday in the title game. I knew we were going to do it. Coming to UCLA, we all set out for a goal, and I imagined this moment, Jaquez said. I imagined it so many times, and I am just so, so proud. Crying a lot, the confetti, all of the fans being here to support us, my family being here, it just means everything. Celebrating with this group, like, I'm so happy. The near-record, lopsided victory completed the Bruins' journey through this year's March Madness. The Bruins ran through their opponents this season, with their only loss coming in November to Texas in a Thanksgiving tournament. It's immeasurably more than I could ask or imagine, UCLA coach Corey Close said. It's beyond my wildest dreams. UCLA, 37-1, was led by Betts and her fellow seniors and graduate students like Jaquez, who played all 4 years with the Bruins. She also had 10 rebounds and 5 assists in front of her brother Jamie, who plays for the Miami Heat and flew in to attend the game to watch his alma mater win. The group that Coach Close put together through a combination of high school commitments and transfer portal players capped off their stellar careers with a championship scoring all the points in the title game. Connectivity, attention to detail. You know, I looked them in the eyes before in the locker room before the game and I said, "I'm so proud to be able to say this," Close said, "because all year we've been saying the talent is our floor, but our character will determine our ceiling." The title is UCLA's first since winning the 1978 AIAW championship, which was the postseason tournament for women's basketball before the NCAA took over in 1982. The championship game loss was the second straight for the Gamecocks, who won the title in 2024. Dawn Staley and her Gamecocks, 36-4, will be favored to return to the game's biggest stage with a talented group of expected returnees, led by Joyce Edwards and Agat Mekhir. Like their 51-44 semifinal win over Texas, the Bruins were locked in defensively, anchored by Betts. She finished with 11 rebounds and exited the game with 3:45 left, giving Close a huge hug. The 6'7" senior earned most outstanding player honors of the final four. "We just didn't have it today," Staley said. "We tried, but we just didn't have it. They were the better team." South Carolina avoided the most lopsided loss in championship history of 33 points, set in 2013 when UConn defeated Louisville. The Gamecocks also surpassed the title game record low of 44 points by Louisiana Tech in 1987 against Tennessee. The Gamecocks were trying to cement their name as the premier program in the sport with a fourth championship and a third in the past five seasons. It just wasn't meant to be Sunday, as they had their worst shooting game of the season against a talented UCLA team. "This is not the ending we wanted, but we got here. No one thought we would, and we did," said Tessa Johnson, who led South Carolina with 14 points. Suarez unravels Sox blow lead and crushing loss. In the early innings of Sunday's series finale, the Red Sox looked like a team on the cusp of finally turning their frigid start to the season around. They took a 4-0 lead and knocked San Diego Padres starter Walker Buehler out of the game in the bottom of the third. Then Ranger Suarez came undone. Greg Weissert found himself on the receiving end of a Manny Machado go-ahead blast, and the Red Sox dropped their home opener series 8-6. A start that began oddly but meticulously for Suarez ended prematurely and in concerning fashion. After facing the minimum number of Padres batters through three innings, the Red Sox starter exited one batter into the top of the fifth, charged with four earned runs on six hits, two walks, and two strikeouts. The Padres were unable to keep runners on the bases early on, thanks in part to Suarez, who flashed Gold Glove caliber defense in the first three innings. The Red Sox starter issued a one-out walk to right fielder Fernando Tatis Jr. in the top of the first, then started on an inning-ending 1-6-3 double play on a comebacker from center fielder Jackson Merrill. In the top of the second, Miguel Andujar reached base on a throwing error by veteran shortstop Trevor Story, only to be out advancing to second on a quick recovery and throw by first baseman Wilson Contreras. Story entered the day tied with teammate Sedan Rafaela, who didn't start Sunday's game, for third worst chase rate in the majors, 51.2%, and went 1-for-5 with two strikeouts in the contest. He's now batting 119 with a 333 OPS and has made three errors. Asked if he still wants Story hitting in the number two spot in the lineup, Cora answered, "I still like Trevor Story as a player." The Red Sox are 2-7 to start the season for just the sixth time since 1950. They open up their fourth series Monday evening against the incoming Milwaukee Brewers, who are 7-2. Left-hander Patrick Sandoval Elbow will make his first rehab start Wednesday in AAA Worcester after his original Sunday game with AA Portland was postponed due to rain. Right-hander Cutter Crawford Wrist threw an up-and-down on the field at Fenway on Sunday morning. He is slated to begin a rehab assignment in the next week. Asked Sunday if MLB's new automatic ball strike system puts more pressure on pitchers like Ranger Suarez to be more precise, his manager answered no. I think he was precise anyway, so I don't, Cora said. Honestly, I haven't seen a change in the game. There are certain calls here and there, but as you can see, teams have been very cautious, especially in this series. I know we talk about our team challenging in low leverage situations, but if you look in the whole to the whole league, everybody's doing the same thing. The only thing that we're not doing with the league is being successful in these challenges early, and that's where you lose it. But I think the game is being run the same way. Saturday, there were some calls that probably we could have challenged early on or them, but teams are being more cautious now, so I think it's going to flow. And for guys like Sonny Gray, for Suarez, it's going to be basically the same. The Red Sox entered Sunday's 4-3 in batter challenges and 2-4 in fielding challenges, pitcher or catcher. Their overall challenge attempts and number of successful overturns rank near the bottom of the MLB leaderboard. I was surprised, Cora said, of seeing his team as below the league in low leverage challenge situations. I think it's more about the conviction. There's some 50-50 pitches that you're like, maybe, maybe not. There's others that you're like, yeah, you should be a strike. But I think we'll keep getting better, and I think it's going to become more interesting later on. Like, little by little, teams are going to wait, and from the seventh inning on, it's actually going to start playing. Cora reiterated that the Red Sox haven't told any of their hitters not to challenge. Only their pitching staff. Zidane Rafaela has developed a reputation for making the most impossible catches in center field. The downside of such reliability is that even the smallest miscue seems shocking by comparison, such as the Fernando Tatis Jr. two-out double that sailed over Rafaela's head with two outs in the top of the ninth and the game tied 2-2 on Saturday. The San Diego Padres ultimately triumphed 3-2 thanks to a Ramon Laureano RBI single. Rafael also lost on another otherwise surefire catch in the blinding afternoon sunlight during Friday's home opener. But manager Alex Cora took a brighter view, literally. You cannot beat the sun, Cora said Sunday morning. I mean, the sun is like 10 million wins, no losses, right? It's been there forever. I think he's the best defender in center field, he said. I'll take my chances every time he's out there. Cubs pitchers combined for one hitter in win over Guardians. Miguel Amaya hit an RBI single in the eighth inning, only the second hit for Chicago, and four Cubs pitchers combined for a one hitter in a 1-0 victory over the Cleveland Guardians on Sunday in the opener of a traditional doubleheader. Amaya's hard shot to right center field off Connor Brogdon, 2-1, scored pinch runner Dylan Carlson from second base. The Guardians managed only one hit, a double that possibly could have been caught against Cubs starter Edward Cabrera and relievers Caleb Thielbar, Hobie Milner, and Daniel Palencia, who worked a perfect ninth for his first save. Pirates 8, Orioles 2. Ryan O'Hearn homered and matched a career high with four RBIs as the Pittsburgh Pirates beat the Baltimore Orioles 8-2 on Sunday to sweep a three-game series and extend their winning streak to 5. O'Hearn hit a two-run shot to right center in the first inning. In the second, his two-run double highlighted a four-run outburst as the Pirates pushed their lead to 6-0. Rays 4, Twins 1. Richie Palacios hit a two-run homer in a three-run 10th inning, and the Tampa Bay Rays beat the Minnesota Twins 4-1 on Sunday. Junior Caminero also went deep for Tampa Bay, which concluded a 9-game, 11-day season-opening road trip with a 900th career win for manager Evan Bourne.